Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15 for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
Welcome back to a very mournful episode of Still Watching Mayor of Easttown. I'm Vanity Fair senior writer Joanna Robinson.
And I am a bereft Vanity Fair chief critic Richard Lawson.
Welcome to our wake for a character that we loved. We're gonna probably kick off talking about poor Zabel and what happened here, obviously. But if you're just joining us for the first time, what we do here in Still Watching is Richard and I pick a show that we're watching week to week. We break it down. We go really granular. I mean, we got a lot of suspects and theories this week. There's a lot of questions, and I haven't seen beyond this episode, so I am in the same boat as anyone else. I have no idea what's coming next. So we're going to talk about all of that. And sometimes on this show, we're lucky enough to have folks who worked on the show come and chat with us. And this week we have, the ghost of Evan Peters. Evan Peters himself is here. You might have heard last week, Evan was supposed to be on last week's episode. And then I talked to him and we kind of wanted to talk about this episode instead, understandably. So we held the interview a week and then we tried to cut out all references to Evan being on last week's episode. But I think we left one little vestigial reference. And so I think a bunch of people were like, where's the Evan interview? Here it is, folks. We're going to hear it at the top of this episode. You don't even have to wait till the end of this episode to hear it. So we're going to talk about that. We're going to go to that probably after we talk about some of your emails. But this is episode 5, Illusions. Richard Lawson, what kind of emails do we have this week?
Well, we once again got a lot of emails, and we appreciate them. Keep them coming. Unfortunately, a lot of the emails we got this week were sort of rendered moot by this episode, because people were really basing off of episode 4 and everything previous. I think episode 5 clearly solved one mystery and perhaps brought us closer to solving the central mystery of who killed Aaron. I'm not going to read the emails that I think have been a bit negated by this episode, but there were a few that I think definitely are still in play. I like this one because it's kind of just a general assessment of the show. It's from Laura, who says she's formerly of Allentown, so she knows of where she speaks. She writes, I have come to believe that Mayor of Easttown is not a show about murder. It is a show about Mayor and Easttown. I think when all is revealed, we will see that Aaron was killed accidentally by friends or peers. Maybe she is the one who brought a gun to the park in the first place after that horrible beating she took from her ex's girlfriend. Maybe a friend tries to take the gun from her and fires. Maybe peers try to mask the accident by dumping her body in the woods. Whatever happens, I predict that this is not a murder. It's a sad state of events that happens in a down-and-out town. If Mayor's daughter is involved somehow, that will put Mayor and Easttown in a compromised position where no one is ever fulfilled. I think that is an appropriately bleak assessment of what might be going on. It's unclear after this episode if Laura's sort of general theory of it being an accident is true or not. But I do think that, as we've been talking about on this podcast for a few episodes now, I do think that this conclusion is not going to be one of, aha, we got the killer. I think it's going to be a lot more, you know, sort of resigned and despondent than that.
Yeah, and you were the one, I think, who pointed out early on, like, to keep in mind the what we know forensically about the scene, which is, you know, Aaron maybe putting up a hand offensively, the bullet going sort of wildly and lodging in a tree somewhere, ricocheting into a tree somewhere. So it does really feel like maybe two people were wrestling over a gun and it went off, and Aaron, it feels like an accident. And whether that accident, you know, was by someone who met Aaron ill in the first place or not, we can discuss, and we've got some prime suspects here in this episode. But I do keep thinking about that, about how this is all going to be like a really sad accident. And are we going to see it? Like, are we going to, you know, this is a show that's done a little bit of flashbacks. Are we going to see what happened that night, or just are we just going to hear about it? I don't know. We'll find out.
Find out soon enough. So kind of narrowing more into a theory, this is an email from Susie, who says, I just finished listening to your episode for Mayor of Easttown podcast. I agreed with you both that the scene with Ryan watching the news report was pretty strange, and I wondered if he knows something about who did it. My theory is that John Ross is involved somehow, and that Frank knows something about this as well. I think if John was the father, then Frank might have delivered diapers to Aaron for John. John and Frank look enough alike that Jess might have mistaken them. Frank would cover up for John, at least about being the father of Aaron's baby. The show deals a lot with duality. There are so many similarities in the lives and the pasts of multiple characters. We have people in similar situations with children, grandchildren, drug abuse, and much more. We also see that people in this little town have to deal with one another despite serious interpersonal issues because they can't escape from each other, and they are all interdependent. People are willing to cover up to keep from hurting each other, like Dawn not telling Beth about Freddie trying to rob her. Bad things of all kinds are really close to Mare and to most of the people in Easttown. The duality motif and the interdependency are both going to play into the identity of the murderer. I think that's really well put, Susie. I would just maybe shift the John to a Billy.
A Billy.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that's interesting. Do you think that Frank would, you know, not tell Mare about if he knew that Billy Ross were the father of Aaron's kid?
I guess it depends on which code is more, you know,
yeah,
is stronger. Is it, do you,
he's
don't?
So, yeah, he's so indignant when she asks him about the paternity test and stuff like that. And, you know, I just wonder, like, if in that moment he would tell her, or if her aggression in that moment, you know, I'm not blaming Mary for that, but, like, would put him on the back foot. And he's like, I'm not, you know, bro code, you know, in effect. I don't know. I like Frank. And I feel like they're trying to make us like Frank, especially in this episode, but maybe they're trying to throw me off. But, you know, Frank's, we're going to talk about Frank and his daughter and stuff in this episode. But I don't want to believe that Frank is covering, maybe. But Billy, definitely. We're going to talk about you, Billy. All right. What else we got?
So the last thing is just a point of clarification from Linda, who writes, regarding your curiosity about why Brad Inglesby, who wrote every episode of the show, is a little fixated on basketball. His family is a well-known basketball family in the Tredyffrin Easttown area. Sorry if I pronounced that first town wrong. His dad played for Villanova and also in the NBA. His brother played for Notre Dame and is now the head coach for the University of Delaware. Okay. This is a deep family legacy that Inglesby is tapping into for both Mayor of Easttown and The Way Back with Ben Affleck, which came out last year.
All right. So that's the basketball mystery solved. I mean, not that it was a huge mystery. I just didn't know, like, how much it was. And I think it's interesting because that whole Lady Hawk legacy shot comes back in this episode when Mara's talking about, like, you know, you do one great thing, they constantly expect that of you, and they don't realize you're just a, you know, you're just a human. All right. Are those the emails that we got
this week?
All right.
We got more, but again, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of theories that were quickly disproven. Thank you guys so much for your emails. And please We will accept all condolences cards, direct them to Richard Lawson for the loss of Detective Zabel. So let's, on that note, let us go now to our interview with the great Evan Peters.
Who's alive? He's alive.
I'm Claire Fallon.
And I'm Emma Gray. We're culture writers, podcasters, and hosts of the show Love to See It.
Every week, we give an unapologetically feminist dissection of reality dating shows, rom-coms, and other romance narratives. We unpack all the weird messages they send us about love, sex, and dating.
And we dive into all the details with special guests like actors, authors, and cultural critics.
You can find Love to See It wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes drop every Tuesday.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah. Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Okay, I'm going to start with what sounds like a very boring question, which is the question everyone asks, which is, what drew you to this project in the first place? But I am very curious in your answer, because this is something different for you. So I was interested.
Well, that was part of it. It was definitely something different. I was sent the project and it, you know, it said Kate Winslet starring in it. And I was just like, yeah, okay. But yeah, I put myself on tape for it and sent it in, and it was, I don't know. I like the idea that it was in a small town. I'm from a small town, and I wanted to play something that was, you know, pretty grounded in sort of the reality that I came from. So I was interested in playing that. And again, it was, you know, an opportunity to work with Kate Winslet and sort of learn from her and see what her process was. So pretty much that.
What did you learn from her process?
I learned details. Kate is a very detail-oriented actress and person, and it was very, very helpful for that. Yeah, I don't know how much I want to give away of her process, but sometimes she would walk up to me and be like, okay, so it's 2:38 p.m. and we just came from the Deacon's place, and we probably stopped for a coffee and kind of, you know, had some lunch, and then now we're here and we're doing this thing. And I'd look at her and be like, damn, was I supposed to do that? I didn't prepare like that. So it was really cool to work with her and really get into the circumstances of the story and the character, and I found it really, really helpful. So, and also, you know, Kate is an amazing person and really empathetic and compassionate and looking out for everybody and a team player and down to earth and is able to, you know, hop in and out of character with such ease, that I was incredibly jealous of that. So it was really cool to see her balance, you know, and juggle and carry this whole show and work insane hours and work so hard and so much and still be, you know, a delightful, lovely person. So it was really awesome working with her.
I was talking to your director, who's the loveliest man, and he was saying that
awesome.
Such a nice guy. And he was just saying that the character, as he was written on the page, he could see someone playing that character very differently. That there is a very different approach to that character. And you guys decided together that this was the sort of bright-eyed, bushy-tailed sort of approach was a good idea. I was wondering if you agree with him that there was a different tack and if you ever considered a sort of different angle on the character.
Yeah, definitely. I think originally we sort of went in more with this hotshot detective. You know, he's got this, he solved this case. He's kind of, you know, he's got the nice coat, you know, he's really sort of playing it up and he shoots pool really well. And I was even doing like pool lessons and stuff like that.
That you never used.
I never got good at. I was like, it's going to take me 5 years to get good at this. I don't know how we're going to do this. But the more we did it and for me, like I was always like, I mean, he's living with his mom, you know, like, and he's like, he's kind of stuck and stunted and like trapped, like his girlfriend, you know, his ex has moved on. It's like 5 years now, you know, since, and she's got kids and a wife and shit like that. So it's like, yeah. So he sort of kind of took this thing, you know, to sort of lift himself up, you know, out of that, you know, he sort of took the, you know, from the PI and sort of took it as his own solving the case. And I think he realized that that was just the worst possible thing that he could do. So now he feels like a total imposter. And like an imposter doesn't, I mean, you could play it a couple of ways. You could play it like where he's like cocky, you know, like overly confident, sort of trying to make up for that. Or you could play it like, you know, he's, you know, totally insecure and has severe imposter syndrome and has no idea what he's doing right here. So it's like, I can relate more to that than the other one. And it would be cool to sort of do this weird, I hate the word meta. I don't even know what it means, but, you know, sort of go in there and be like, okay, I'm going to try to learn from Kate. I'm going to try to do the best job that I can. And, you know, Colin is also going in there trying to learn from Mare and realizes that she's really fucking good at her job and really in tune with her instincts. And I think that Colin has lost that. And so he's trying to get back in touch with that. And also I found it, and Craig as well, it was just much funnier. Oh my God, I can't even talk. It was so much funnier to have him be this sort of floundering, tripping, you know, bumbling, I don't want to say idiot, but just not really knowing what he's doing with Mare, who is so driven and on point. That juxtaposition worked really well, I thought. And just, it was really funny how much she did not want me there. So we just kind of tried to play up how much she hated having me on the case with her. But ultimately you see that he really just wants to do a good job and be great and like, you know, solve the cases, you know, that he works on. He's incredibly passionate about his job. So, you know, I think Mare sees that in him, and then, and his innocence, I think, and his naivete. Is that how you say it? Naivete?
Yeah. Nailed it. Can you talk to me a little bit about, so there's a scene in episode 3, this big, you know, monologue for your character, drunken moment that Craig was telling me was this sort of this really pivotal scene for your character, something that he wanted to make sure really hit with the audience. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how you prepare for that, how you pulled that off, because I think it's the best drunk acting I've ever seen, honestly.
Thank you. A lot of research over the years.
hands-on experience.
Your 20s, you're just blowing your brains out, so that was pretty good. Just drew on all that, but I don't know. I always, you know, the scene was written, he's really drunk. I guess I, you know, for me, it was always kind of that secret that he was keeping, you know, he wanted to be somewhere with his life and he just wasn't. And I, you know, I think everybody can kind of relate to that. You know, you always think you're going to be somewhere and then it's just totally different and it's maybe there in some form, but it's always never what you expected it to be. And I think him sort of stealing that, really taking credit for the information that the PI gathered, I think has been eating away at him. And so I think he's been, you know, trying to kill that with booze. And I think he really likes Mare. I think for me, it was really also like the whole show for me and Colin is really about Mare sort of being this, there's something about her that lifts him up and brings him out of his funk. He's like stuck in the mud, and there's just something about her that really, I think she's such a good detective and so good at it that he wants that. And, yeah, I don't know. I don't know if I'm answering your question properly.
Let me ask you a really boring technical question about it. I was looking closely at it, and your veins are standing out on your face in that scene. Did you like throw your head between your knees between takes, or how did you pull that off?
I don't know. No, I don't know. I guess that sort of happens when I get intense or emotional or something, and veins popping out of my freaking head.
That happens when I've had too much alcohol. So I thought it was like bang on good physical work for you. So yeah.
After that scene, it was like the reason that we were emotional and hugging Craig and I was because I was hysterically sobbing because I thought we didn't get the scene.
Oh,
I was like, we didn't get it. I can't do this. I'm terrible. I'm going to shadow you, Craig, and be a director because I can't fucking do it anymore. And he was like, okay, it's okay. It's okay. You're cool, man. I think we got it. And I'm like, I don't know, man. I think I need to move on. I can't do this. And then, then Mark Borba was like, oh, you know, that people are like kind of really liking that scene. And I was like, oh, really? So it was like, it was such a huge relief, to read your article. So thank you so much for that.
Oh yeah, of course.
But also like, you know, what's going on with my internal judgment where I don't even know if it's good or not.
Love that imposter syndrome. We all grapple with it, I think. Some of us more than others. I'm wondering about the COVID break and what opportunity that gave you to really work on the character. And, because Craig was like, we were busy during the pandemic, by the way, we were working on the project.
Yeah. Well, we had they, in March, they punted it, you know, to September. So, we had some time off. I don't know how much time he had off. I think he was editing a lot of what we already shot.
Right.
And then, and then we came back and it was just like the masks and the shields and the testing and sort of this weird, you know, fear and paranoia of there's this disease around you. So it was trying to navigate that and sort of get back into, the Philly accent and all the weird things that came along with it.
Is that another thing that you thought you didn't get was the accent? Because everyone has said that yours is the best one, or
really
one of the best ones. Yeah.
Dude. Oh, that's great. Yeah. Yes. To answer your question. Yeah. Definitely felt like I didn't get that. No, I had a great, that was another thing about Kate too. She'd be like, Zabes, babes, what's going on, babes? And she's so British, and you have no, like, I've always seen her as American, and then she would pop it into it and just be like, did you get that file on Katie Bailey? She filed a police report. It was just like, how the hell are you doing that? That is awesome. I had to listen to this guy named Steve. I don't want to say his last name, but he's Steve, kind of a friend of the production, and we had a great dialect coach, Suzanne Solby, who, you know, got some great tapes of him speaking about, you know, the mums that he planted, and, you know, he's gonna do that Saturday, and you know, for home for Thanksgiving, and he was just talking about his family and his kids, and for like 20 minutes, and every morning I would listen to it. I would just wake up and make my coffee and listen to that thing, and by the end I was just like repeating it in time with him, and it was just so crazy. It was like Groundhog's Day, but I had to do it because I was like, I fall out of this accent so quickly. And it's so scary, you know, doing an accent like that, because I have never heard anything like it in my life.
Yeah.
Ever. I didn't even know it existed.
Tricky. Yeah.
It's
yeah.
Very, it's very strange and hilarious. So by the end, I loved it and it was fun to do, but it was like, dude, this is bizarre. Go ahead. Been on the shore.
I have to ask you about what you make of Zabel's death here in this, in episode five, because it's shocking, not just because of it's so sudden, but it's comes right after this moment where you really feel like he's learned something from Mare. He's going to go in a different direction in his life. You know, he says like, I've played it safe my whole life to his mom. Like, where'd that get me? And then, you know, bullet in the head. I was like, when I first saw it, I was like, surely it missed him. And then I saw yeah. all the blood on the ground. I was like, no. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. So what do you make of that for poor Zabel?
Poor Zabes. I don't know. It's I always found it just so shocking and real, you know. I think sickness and death and all that stuff just sort of hits you when you least expect it. So I felt like it was a very interesting and real choice. And you know, it always reminded me of that moment in Burn After Reading when Brad Pitt gets shot. forehead in the closet, and he did it so brilliantly because he, like, his character's hilarious and he looks yeah. up, he like smiles, he's like, hey, I didn't do anything, bam, right in the forehead. But it's incredibly shocking, I think, as an audience member to watch that. And I think it just adds to the reality of being a detective and working in a field that is, you know, can be incredibly dangerous. So yeah, but it was shocking reading it, absolutely, for sure.
I wanted to ask you maybe one, maybe two more questions, which is, how did you incorporate Zabel's faith?
Yeah, his mom's Catholic. I was raised Catholic. I went to a Catholic grade school, and you know, it's interesting. I don't practice Catholicism at all. I'm pretty agnostic, actually. I don't really know, I think, is where I stand right now. And I think I kind of did that for Zabel too. I don't know what ended up in the edit, but I think he's struggling with that because I think, you know, you see so much darkness as a detective daily, and that it really, I think it can, and not for everybody, but in my imagination, I figured it would really throw your faith pretty drastically, you know, sort of seeing all this awful stuff happening around you daily. So I think he's struggling with it. And you know, it's a thing also, like breaking away from mom. Like, you know, his mom is a practicing Catholic and, you know, wants him to be practicing Catholic. And it's sort of that, again, trying to break off from your family and your parents and sort of be your own man. And I think that was really the ultimate goal for Callan, I think, is to become a man and like fucking get your own place, dude. It's time. It's time. You can do it. We believe in you. So it was this weird, he's kind of like a man boy, and Mare sort of elevates him into a man and sort of says, you know, get out of this shit. You're stuck and you need to grow up and break off from your mom and have your own beliefs and have your own ideas and formulate your own opinions. I think that's sort of what we were trying to do with that.
And then my last question for you, and thank you again for taking the time today on your weekend.
Of course. Yeah. Thanks you too.
Is you've been working steadily for so long, but I'm curious if doing this project makes you want to do anything differently going forward, or, you know, whether it be Shadow Craig and become a director or anything else like that.
Yeah. I know. Really, honestly, I texted him the other day. I was like, dude, I still, you know, next thing you do, like, I want to come there, and I want to, cause he's such an awesome person and an awesome director. I've never, you know, he was just so, his energy is great, as you know, and very collaborative and creative and trying new things each take. And it was really an awesome experience working with him. So I would love to chat on him. And I also, in terms of acting, like I like this sort of, I think I want to try to do some more, some more like really sort of still and kind of, I don't want to call it mundane, but more like everyday life kind of projects. I've been watching a lot of that stuff recently, and I really like it. It's really incredible and authentic and scary in that way, and really moving and effective. So I want to try to do some more stuff like that, going down the pipe, but we'll see.
Can I ask you just really quickly, what those things you are that you're watching that you're enjoying?
I knew you were going to ask that. I knew it. Let's see, I have this great list. Oh, I'm not even going to pronounce this right, so I'm sorry. Is it Ohazard Balthazar, 1966? And the whole thing, a donkey is sort of the central character of this film, and it's some of the best acting I've ever seen. This thing is just doing nothing, and it has this face, and it's sort of everything that's surrounding him that is it's so incredible and moving and effective. I was shocked. This donkey deserves an award. And then I watched Strozek, which was great. Uzak was amazing. That was just very still and silent. Gummo. Oh, Buffalo 66 was cool too. That's not quite in the same vein, but it was sort of.
Yeah.
Intense. Yeah, intense. Very intense. Oh, A Woman Under the Influence.
Great movie. Great
fantastic.
Movie. Yeah.
Fantastic movie.
Yeah.
And fantastic performances, and such a bizarre movie, and so much time. That was the other thing too. Like, what I'm really liking about these movies is that there's so much time. Like, it's so stretched out. Like, and the little things that they do are not cut out, you know, they're in the movie, and it makes it so much more interesting and real and exciting to watch. So, I'm really into that stuff right now. I don't know why, but yeah.
I think it makes sense after the year we've had. I think those are good things to dwell in. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Back to basics.
All right. So this is where we're going to start. We're going to start with poor dead Zabel. Richard, you texted me after you watched this episode. I knew this from the beginning, because I watched all five episodes. But I told you this, and I just sort of want to share this with our listeners. Sometimes when you're pressed and you get episodes in advance, you get rough cuts. So you get, major effects still need to be done.
Right.
And so I've rewatched this episode a couple times. So I've seen it now with the full effects done. But when I saw it, Evan Peters gets shot. There's no major blood splatter that happens on the wall, because that's special effects that happen later. And then all of the cell phone stuff, like officer down, or the like surveillance video of him definitely dead on the floor. None of that was in my episode that I watched the first time, because they do the cell phone stuff later. And so I was like holding out hope. I was like, it seems like he got shot in the head, but I'm not ready to admit that that's what happened. And then finally they showed his like a lot of blood, and his lifeless body on the floor. I was like, I had to accept it. So, okay. We know you're upset, Richard, and I'm upset too. So let's talk about that first, and then maybe like narratively, what does this do for you?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I kind of was like you. I was like Homer Simpson watching his roast pig roll through town saying, it's still good. It's still good. And I was like, he could be okay. Maybe it was just his shoulder. Maybe it grazed his head, you know, and then yeah, he's very much dead. I think I texted you. I was like, at the minute he kissed her, I knew that was it. He was dead.
They got me. I did not see it coming.
And I really did, you know, I appreciated, I'm assuming, the sort of homage to the beginning of the really scary final sequence of Silence of the Lambs, where she's going to this house to just ask kind of innocent questions.
Right.
And then it dawns on her like, oh, this is the killer. Or, you know, in this case, at least the kidnapper.
That's why last week I kept calling him Silence of the Lambs guy, because I had this sequence in mind.
Yes.
So I was like leaning into that. But yeah, absolutely. It feels very intentionally that. Okay.
And it was really well done. It was scary. It was obviously sad. It was interesting to watch Kate Winslet do a little bit of action. Narratively, I don't know what comes of it. I mean, I think that obviously there are going to be a lot of questions about why Mare was there, because she's not supposed to be there.
Right.
But she also did get the guy, so maybe there that kind of gives her a pass for it. But do I love, in a writing sense, that they have burdened Mare with yet another grief? No, maybe it's a lot for one character to have on their shoulders. But I think that something, this sort of shocking and violent, I think maybe needed to happen, lest we kind of forget how serious the stakes are with this storyline, you know, because it's not, this seems not related to Aaron's case at all, but it's really serious and it's really dire and dark and grim. And I think, you know, as a kind of way to communicate that, there had to be this kind of violent and fatal standoff, I guess.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, it's interesting that it's Zabel. And something that, you know, Evan Peters talked about when I was like, why? You know, is he was just talking about death and how this episode treats death in general. That, you know, we see this old woman die, Betty Carroll, who we've met before in the
series. The first character we met in the show,
yeah,
other than
Mary. Exactly. And then we see this young man who is sort of, I mean, I asked Evan about this, but there's that line where, you know, he says to his mom, like, you know, I put it safe all my life. What has that gotten me? And you're like, oh, my God, be safer. You know, and the whole sequence, it is very suspenseful. Mare doesn't have a gun. You know, and Kate Winslet is giving us real fear in that moment because she is defenseless. And the, you know, there's been this narrative question throughout of like, why do we have this moment where Mare plants the drugs on Carrie? It just, you know, was it just to get the character in therapy? You know, there's a lot of therapy in this episode, which we'll talk about. Was it to get her in this position where she's at this crime scene and she's relatively defenseless because she doesn't have a gun? Would she have been able to stop the guy before he shot Zabel? She noticed it before Zabel did, you know? So it's like, maybe. And it's just a tragedy and it's so sad. And to me, it feels narratively curious because they're doing so much in this episode to like set him up. But then like maybe it's just the last confession of Colin Zabel, where he's like, I didn't solve that case in Darby. Like his whole imposter syndrome, like everything. And that's what Evan Peters is saying. He's like, the way that Zabel was initially written, I think it was supposed to be much more of like a brash hotshot cop character. And he and Craig, the director, you know, and I'm sure working with Brad, sort of decided it was more interesting for Colin to come in as this sort of earnest, eager to please person. And the way that Evan sort of like tapped into that was this idea of imposter syndrome, this idea that he's pretended that he solved this big case and he comes in and he desperately wants to solve this case too, but does not feel like he is not coming in sure that he can. Right. And so that he can sort of turn that lie into a truth. Like if he solves this case, then that lie becomes true. He has rescued some girls, you know, or solved a big case. So, I don't know. And maybe it's good that Zabel's off the table in a certain sense, because this is called Mare of Easttown. And I will admit that I was getting distracted by like Evan Peters' great and empathetic performance. And I thought he was a fantastic part of the show, but like, I don't mind having two episodes just to focus on Kate and everything she's doing, you know?
Yeah, no, totally. And I think, you know, from a thematic perspective, what makes this all the more tragic is that, and in an effective way, is that what Zabel represented in a lot of his scenes, especially with Mare, was this kind of this lightness that was not affected by Easttown, you know, mm-hmm. and he had an optimism to him, a sort of guilelessness that I think she found both obnoxious and kind of, but also appealing, you know. And then the town got him like it gets so many other people, you know?
Ooh, yeah.
I think that's so like, it's just so sad and sort of like, I don't know, like a kind of depressing conclusion about this town's kind of toxic gravity, I guess.
Is Easttown the Hellmouth?
Like what's maybe.
what do you make of the audio of Kevin the child playing over the end. Like, is this, I mean, we know they shared a kiss. Like, Evan Peters is in his 30s. He's not a child. But, like, is it that, like, innocence that, like, you know, he's a younger man? Like, is that what she's thinking about there? Or is it connected to something else? Because she's been thinking about Kevin as a kid all episode. But what do you make of that audio coming in?
And she's been talking about her dad who shot himself. And here is a young man who's shot in the head. Mm-hmm. And her son he's killed himself. I don't know if we know what method he used. But I think that something that maybe sort of metaphorically they're doing with that scene is in this town and many towns around the country with the opioid crisis, a lot of people have had to deal with a lot of dead young people and dead older people as well. But to be so confronted by the physical fact of that, in addition to all the sort of metaphysical stuff, I think is really scarring, especially when it's repetitive, you know. And I think that Mayor sitting there in front of, well, two dead people, while young women are, you know, locked upstairs, like, I think that of course that would sort of zoom her back to this sort of, I mean, I guess her father is kind of the original trauma, but the Kevin thing is the one that seems, you know, rawest for her. It makes total sense, you know, because it just, Zabel's death becomes this kind of part of this like aggregate horror and grief that she, and I think probably many other people in the town are sort of living in all the time.
Yeah. The thing, we're going to talk about Betty a little bit more in detail in a second, but the thing that I think this episode does so brilliantly at the beginning is, you know, Betty Carroll dies and runs her car into, the light pole or whatever. And, we see how that affects multiple households in town. And to me, it just felt like a nice indicator of, how interconnected and interdependent everything is, you know. And it's just like, it's this like interlocking network, and one domino falls and it just sort of, it hits everyone. So it's, you know, a blackout is a nice narrative device for various things that we learn in these households, but it also just, I think, comes back to that, how everything is connected. Let's talk about before we get to Betty, let's talk about the girls really quickly. You had sort of floated this theory last week that maybe the kidnapping had to do with someone trying to, take girls off the streets and detox them or something like that. We do see them going through detox. You know, Katie helping Missy the way that this other girl, Hillary, had helped her. But this guy is also sexually assaulting these women. So yeah. It's a really disturbing scenario. We're very glad that those girls, you know, that Mayor found them. And I do like all the detective work that we see in this episode. Mayor working her sources, and seeing them door knock as well. Like that, you know, they have that conversation, the coffee, the kiss, how do you know what I want, all that sort of stuff. And then they get a call. And that call could have taken them directly to the tavern, but it, you know, we follow them around door to door to door before they get to the tavern, which is, I thought, a really smart piece of thing. Anyway, so what landed for you about the girls and working the case in that way this episode?
What I loved about how they solved it was that they talked to another young woman who maybe hadn't been listened to.
Yeah.
And they found out that this was kind of like a known thing, that this event had happened to her, you know, and she got away and then, you know, sort of lived in fear of him and an awareness of him, but obviously couldn't or didn't feel comfortable going to the police. And so Mayor had to, you know, reach out to her friend who had been or still is a sex worker, but is older and kind of goes to some of the spots where they work and to check on them sometimes and had heard the story. And, you know, I think that someone had written to us about how the Jacob Wetterling case, which was a famous murder case in Minnesota from the, I believe, early 90s, was eventually solved, that they talked to the local kids and actually listened to them, you know. And I think in this instance, it shows that, like, there is a absolute, of course, value in listening to people, even if they have been sort of pushed to the margins of society or whatever. I think that was a very credible way for this show to begin that process of revealing who had been taking these girls, because they would know. And it's very telling that the police really hadn't engaged with them on that level until that point.
We got an email that we didn't read on air about, I think I called Mayor a good cop, and someone was like, how can you call her a good cop when she plants drugs on this girl? And also, should we be more interrogative of cop narratives, given the conversations we've been having about the police force and abuses of power over the last year and a half? And I agree with that. So I want to be very careful in what I say here about Mayor, which is that she is putting in the work on this case, right? And the way this case is solved is not an accidental discovery. It's working sources. And also her empathy for this, like, this sex worker feels probably like she was someone maybe Mayor arrested a couple times and then became maybe a source. And then, you know, they have this like longstanding friendship, and Mayor has empathy for these girls, for this source, all this sort of stuff like that. And so I appreciate them showing us Mayor doing this work, and it is work that, you know, winds up hopefully saving these girls who will forever be traumatized by their experience, but are at least still alive. So, yeah. All right, let's talk about the death of Betty Carroll. It's not funny, but then it is a little funny, because that's what Mayor of Easttown does. It sprinkles in some humor for us as a treat. So we get, you know, her car crashes. She has a heart attack. She dies. We get the blackout. We'll talk about that a little bit. Then we get the wake. And we get the revelation that Betty's husband had an affair with Helen, Mayor's mom. And great bit of comedy cut to Mayor just laughing her ass off in the car with her mom, and her mom sort of being flustered about it. does this soothe your sorrows a little bit, Richard, this bit of comedy?
I mean, it was really good, and it was fun to hear Mayor / Kate Winslet laughing like that, you know. Mm-hmm. I also think that it was funny at the wake when people were like, oh, she was such a sweet woman or whatever. And it was like, well, no, we've met this character. She was, she wasn't that exactly, you know, calling kids weird looking and various stuff. So I, you know, yes. Was it a bit of a kind of high comedy thing to have a character say at a wake in front of everyone, you know, that this thing happened? Sure. But I think it was a nice kind of moment of levity that actually now in retrospect feels like a kind of trick. It's like, This is a fun episode, and then she and Zabel are going to go on a date, and then he's going to kiss her, and then it's like, oh, wait, no, it's heading toward this bleak, terrible thing. But it also was a good, you know, excuse to talk about that Jean Smart is in a great show coming out on HBO Max this week, I believe, called Hacks, where she plays a Vegas comedian, and she's fabulous in it. So if you like
so good
more of that Jean Smart mode, go check out that show.
If you go to the Mayor of Easttown IMDb page right now, it is just splashed with Hacks ads. And I'm like, very well done.
Smart.
Good job. All right. Let's talk about Siobhan and Frank. In this blackout moment, we get this, you know, and this is what I love about the show, is it finds moments of interconnectedness. And like the thing that I should say about Helen is like, we find out a couple things. We find out Helen had an affair. We find out that Helen's husband killed himself when Mayor is talking about her mom in therapy, and how like her mom just sort of, whenever Mayor's dad was having a depressive episode, he would just like leave the house and go stay somewhere else. And that her mom just never really, and we know Helen at this point, but she's not just a comedic relief character, right? Because she has this moment with Carrie in the bath. And then we think about who Helen is as a person, and like how her husband killed himself when her kid was only 13, and then how her grandson killed himself, and how she's desperately afraid she's going to lose her great grandson to Carrie, and all of that. Like the space this show has for depth of character on almost every level, I think is really extraordinary. But for Siobhan and Frank, we get this moment where he checks in with Siobhan, and he says something that I think we've talked about, this idea that Siobhan has had to be like more mature than her age because of all the problems with her brother. Mm-hmm. And maybe ignored because they were trying to deal with or help Kevin, and having Frank check in with her in this moment, I thought was a really, I was thinking maybe he was disturbed by what happened with Aaron and what's happening with these other girls. And he's like, maybe I should check in with my, the young girl in my life and see how she's doing, you know?
Yeah. You can't take for granted that she's doing well. I mean, you know, by some metrics, they've gotten very lucky with Siobhan because she's, you know, on the straight and narrow. Her girlfriend is convincing her to apply to schools in California. Like she's, you know, she might be quote getting out, which I guess probably sort of a bittersweet hope for people in Easttown, or parents of kids in Easttown. Yeah, I thought that scene was nice. I think it also did a lot of work. I think you mentioned this at the beginning of this episode, like to take some, like a lot of the guilty eye off of Frank in any respect, you know. I do think that he might still have some kind of knowledge, but I think him bringing Aaron baby stuff and then him talking to Siobhan about this, like I think it goes a long way toward like showing that he's just kind of a caring person who is a little bit maybe more attuned to some people's needs than other people around him are.
And not like the show is definitely about who will Mare end up with or any of that sort of thing. But I feel like, you know, given all the rumblings of troubles with Faye and Frank in this episode, you know, the show is kind of trying to put Frank potentially back in the game as like, are Mare and Frank going to reconcile? Are they going to be able to like sort of, Mare's in therapy. Let's talk about Mare in therapy. Like if Mare is going to therapy, like maybe she and Frank can, you know, not that they need to get back together, but maybe they might, you know, maybe that's a healing way forward for everyone. Like I said, I'm not sure if this whole suspension thing was some sort of narrative push to get this character who would never go to therapy on her own, maybe into therapy. But here she is. And this is another scene that, you know, Kate Winslet just crushed talking about the history of mental illness in her family. This is such a common, obviously common, you don't even have to be in, you know, Easttown, Pennsylvania for this to be a common thing where mental health issues are generationally seen and ignored and pushed aside and not recognized as a pattern. And hopefully that's something that's evolving and changing as the way we talk about mental health is changing. But I loved the way that this was written for Mare, where it's clear that she's been engaging it. She's been reading articles. She's very worried about it, but she's still got a bit of a chip on her shoulder. Like, but you know, we don't talk about this. Like this isn't something we talk about.
And I think that also, you know, without saying it outright, it gets at a persistent fear of a lot of people who are in the middle of perhaps that generational conference of, you know, mental ill health problems or whatever, you know, is that like, did I give this to my kid? Mm-hmm. You know, and that fear and that guilt, I think, again, without it being literalized in you know, in Mare's mouth, like I think it was clearly implied that was a really big part of her concern. I also wanted to mention that the therapist is played by Asa Davis, who is a great playwright as well as an actor. So if you're ever in New York and she has something on, you should go see it. Again, this show is just pulling a lot of great people from New York, which I think is fun. But yeah, I mean, I think that, look, therapy, you know, since The Sopranos and certainly before that, I mean, the original Thomas Crown Affair, right? Doesn't he talk to a therapist in that? Or maybe he only talks with therapists in the new one and then it's Faye Dunaway. Okay. Anyway, like therapy is maybe an overplayed device. I think a lot of shows get wrong how, at least in my experience, therapy kind of is and how it goes in an individual session, you know.
I think Big Little Lies often got it very wrong. That's what I'll say.
I think those scenes in Big Little Lies were electric because the two actors were so good. But yes, I think you're very right about its methodology was not accurate. But look, it's a device for a reason. It's a really simple and malleable way to get stuff out, you know, in a way that characters wouldn't normally speak unless in such a formal setting where they're kind of required to speak. So I don't really mind it. And I think when it's as well acted and shrewdly written as this was, it works really well.
I also really liked Mare's discovering the documentary, but not like confronting Siobhan about it. It was a very natural way for her to discover it, looking for the turtle in the blackout. And then, you know, it's something that is haunting her for the rest of the episode. This time in her life when she was connected to her son, her really, really connecting to what she lost, not just thinking about the end and when it got really bad, but the beginning and how beautiful that was, and hearing her voice on that video is gutting, you know? Mm-hmm. And I just thought that was really, really well done. And then I think the, you know, maybe the last thing we need to talk about in terms of this subject is, you know, when Mare is talking about her father killing himself, that really shadows her decision to be like her father, right? To be a cop like her dad. We knew that that's, you know, she became a cop because her dad was a cop, and that's what she decided to do. But we didn't know her dad killed himself when she was 13. And that just makes it much stickier, you know, that that's the road yeah. she decided to go down. So, all right, let's talk about the Rosses. Not all of the Rosses, but a lot of the Rosses. We've got Lori and John. Lori, as everyone recalls, is Mary's best friend, her husband John, and their kids Ryan and Moira. Ryan, we flagged last week because of that scene where he comes in and we're like, could it be Ryan? I've known a couple people who are very suspicious of Ryan. I don't know if this actually clears them of suspicion, but a possible explanation for all of his behaviors and all the times that we've seen him be a little hinky is that he's keeping the secret for his dad, that his dad is cheating, John is cheating on Lori. And, you know, Ryan acts out at school in defense of his sister, but acts out at school, all this sort of stuff. Does this satisfy your questions about Ryan, or like could Brian still be involved somehow in everything?
I think it satisfies my questions about Ryan almost. My hunch is that what this is doing is setting Lori up, and maybe everyone kind of around her, to be like, okay, the secret has been unearthed. He's cheating again with the same woman, and now he's moving out and he's going to deal with it. Time to move on. And then the kind of bigger reveal is going to be, oh, wait, no, I'm looking in the wrong direction. This is the secret, you know, and it has to do with Aaron or whatever. And I don't think that Billy killed Aaron, but I do think that he is the father based on that interaction, where Mayor is clearly now smelling something, you know. I think it was just kind of a way to show that, like, there are other things happening in these people's lives, that they're not kind of hanging in stasis when we're not, Mayor isn't talking to them about the case. Like, there are things going on. I think that the scene between Lori and Ryan was just showing, like, you know, like Siobhan, like a lot of other characters, like what a burden this young person is carrying, you know? And oftentimes how the family bonds and loyalties can be exploited. I mean, what his father was doing, like, keep this between us, that's really shitty.
That's so gross.
Terrible thing to do.
Yeah.
And I think that that doesn't mean that John is a terrible person overall necessarily, but like there's a lot being put on a lot of people in this show, and a lot of kind of care that is good, but a lot that is also kind of manipulated and used selfishly.
Yeah. The kids are not all right, like, by any stretch. Yeah, so, there's some shred of a possibility that, like, maybe, but I just don't know what Ryan would be doing out in the park in the middle of the night, so I gotta clear Ryan Ross. I think he's clear. I think his whole weird behavior was his stress around his dad.
And the kid can wield a lunch tray. I mean, it was impressive.
I was impressed, but put that kid in therapy as well, please. Do we feel like the Prowler question is solved by Mayor tackling this old man and with dementia? Because the ferret drawing came back, and so I was like, is this actually going to be something? It came back again in this episode, but like, do you feel like that's all sewn up, the Prowler question?
I think that's sewn up. I think the show really missed an opportunity for her source to not say, draw me like one of your East Town ferrets.
Ferret girls.
Yeah. I think that was a mistake.
I think there should be a rival basketball team called the East Town Ferrets.
Yeah. I love that. I think the solving, if you want to call it that, of the Prowler question is a nice kind of way to round out this world, that it's like a lot of this stuff that happens in this town, any town, is pretty prosaic and mundane and not actually like some sinister thing, you know, but there is sinister stuff happening. But like it, I don't know. I think it just gives levels to this portrait of this town, that I think is smart, because there's a lot going on that could make this whole thing feel very unrealistic. And then to kind of have this kind of banal sort of, oh, it's just a confused older man. Like, you know, I think that makes a lot of sense to me.
There's also a little bit of nice comedy there, because like Mare has been completely humiliated by what has happened. She's sitting there sort of sulkily vaping on the sidewalk, and then Zabel walks by and she's just had this awful date with him. And it's just, you know.
Yeah.
Sorry, RIP Zabel. Okay, we just have three more things to talk about really quickly. Deacon Mark. Deacon Mark gets, you know, beat up. Some people in town, the word is out on his other allegation. He's been beat up by some kids from a pizza joint, question mark. And then, you know, I think it's Cousin Dan has this conversation with Mark, and Mark explains what happens, fills in a little bit more of the timeline of that night, because they do believe him in this moment. And I believe that this is the end of Deacon Mark's, you know, and like I could see Cousin Dan going to Mare with this information, but I believe that this is the end of Deacon Mark's involvement, guilt. He's guilty of driving Aaron to the scene of the crime. He's guilty of hiding her bike. He's guilty of all of that, but I don't think he killed her. What do you think?
Well, I think, first of all, like, it, you know, there's a kind of an accidental relevance here to like actual news where, like, you know, Biden partly ran on a platform of stopping the scourge of pizza joint kids. He clearly has not done a lot to that. And I think that was a really important thing to show on this show.
East Town Ferrets and the pizza joint kids.
Yeah, all right. Exactly. I mean, pizza joint kids have been menacing me since I was a teenager. Yeah, I think, and I think that if this is the end of the Deacon's kind of involvement in the case, I think, I mean, this maybe sounds bad to say, but like I kind of like narratively that whatever happened in the past with him is left ambiguous, you know, like, or maybe I'm reading it wrong. Is it ambiguous? But like, I'm glad that we're not having to go and like locate like, yes, the exact truth of that story, because,
correct,
that's not what the show is about. And I think that showing this guy is sort of this, who has a very clearly a dark past, just passing through the town into further darkness and maybe out again. Again, that kind of makes sense to me. Like, I'm glad that they didn't try to too neatly fold it into the bigger, you know, the main story.
Okay. I agree with you. I think keeping it ambiguous is more interesting. And I think, and it's a good way to slow roll out information about the night. You know what I mean? Like,
right,
why wouldn't he come forth this information? Well, I have this allegation against me. You know what I mean? And he's not just like, once again, there's just a depth of character here. Like, I felt for him when he was bloody and crying and talking to Dan about what happened. Like, maybe I shouldn't, but I did. So the show is so good at that, at just making you feel for characters you didn't expect that you would. I'm calling an audible. I think you do that in basketball sometimes, certainly in football, but, and I'm switching our last two topics. So, okay, we're going to talk about Billy Ross, and, yep, then we're going to talk about my real suspect. So, okay, Billy fucking Ross, 100% the father of Aaron's kid. That's how I feel right now. How do you feel?
Yeah. I mean, I think Mayor looking at that Rolling Rock and being like, there are prints on that, there's DNA on that. I think that, yeah, was like, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And my hunch would also be that Aaron's dad doesn't know.
Kenny, yeah.
Yeah, obviously, right?
Mm-hmm. So Billy, definitely the father. Do I think he killed her? I don't know. There is a possibility that she was asking him for money for the surgery, and she had a gun or he had a gun. Who knows? There's a struggle and she died. And if you go back, there's plenty of moments where Billy looked weird and distracted and guilty. But I think it's going to be like the Deacon, where like Billy has more information, but not all of the information. And he has a reason for not telling it, because it's incest that he, you know, and sex with a minor and all this other stuff. But I have to imagine he probably gave her that locket. Maybe that locket is like the date her mom died, like, you know, because her mom died of leukemia. She went to go stay with Billy. And maybe that's when this whole thing started. So that seems to be that. And so, yeah, I think we're dealing with three mysteries here. We're two episodes from the end. We know who took Katie and Missy.
Mm-hmm.
We think we know who the father of Aaron's kid is. And I'm gonna call an audible. Not that it's a mystery because he's acting shifty as hell in this episode, but I'm back to Dylan. He's always the boyfriend. I'm back to Dylan. Dylan maybe accidentally killed Aaron. Given the conversation he has with Brianna, Brianna revealing, and once again, there's sympathy in this episode for Brianna, who was just a monstrous asshole at the beginning of the season, and now she's like, well, there goes college, because I was a stupid kid, and I did this really stupid thing, and, you know, but she didn't kill Aaron. And so, you know, and she's asking questions about where Dylan was, and he angrily sends her away, and then does this shifty shit with Aaron's best friend, Jess, the journals, burning the journals just as a piece of information that she scrolled away from the journal in her pocket. I'm curious to see what that is. That I feel like is maybe going to be paternity reveal. Maybe. I don't know. We'll see. But yeah. How are you feeling on the Dylan of it all?
Yeah. And I think that the Jess thing is so heartbreaking because she was her friend, you know, and who knows what her level of involvement was, but you have to kind of think that she went to her mom and then to Lori kind of to deflect, which is like, you know, be like, oh, actually it's Dylan's not the dad, and so kind of putting suspicion on someone else, which like is understandable as a strategy, but is sort of shitty and dishonoring her friend, you know,
disappointing,
like,
yeah,
you know, like, you know, this is her dead friend and she's kind of spilling a secret just to kind of take attention off of, well, Dylan at least. You know, so I feel like this is kind of where the show has been headed ultimately, even if, you know, we've all had our theories, but like this kind of potential reveal of like our emailer said, or, you know, it just some stupid accident or something gone wrong, you know. And I think that the way that the missing girls thing has been solved with, like, it was just some random guy who we hadn't met before. Like, it was a whole other story. I think that makes a lot of sense. And that Aaron's death is much more, like, local. And I don't mean this in the kind of modern context, but, like, pathetic. It's just, like, ugh, you know.
It's always the, you know, it's the ex, but it's, like, it's always the boyfriend. And the fact that, like, yeah, there's this other, like, that we were chasing one suspect, and the fact that there are three, this rando from out of town, Dylan, and Billy, you know. And maybe we can think a little bit more in the coming episodes about sort of what that trifecta means.
Oh, hi, everyone. Joanna here, jumping into the podcast from the future. Oh, no. We recorded this podcast kind of early in the week, and I have since been thinking a lot, and I've completely changed my mind about who I think done it. I don't think... I have a better theory, I guess, is what I want to say. So I laid it all out on VF.com. So you can go to VF.com. But basically, Dylan, Billy, sure, but we still got two more episodes to go. There has to be more mystery, right? So I'm centering my focus on John Ross, and you can read all about it over on VF.com. All right, this is me going away so the episode can come back. All right, bye.
Here we are. I'm excited to find, like I said, I haven't seen what comes next, so I'm excited to see. I'll be missing Zabel a lot. Until we see Colin in our dreams. I don't know. Where will you be, Richard?
Cemetery. Just standing over the grave, weeping. Oh, yeah. Weeping. Yeah. Yeah. Holding a red rose, black veil over my face. It's actually going to be pretty chic, but...
oh my gosh.
But sad. Yes. But sad. And while I'm there, I'll be tweeting from Rylos, writing at VF.com. Joanna, until it's penultimate episode next week, right?
Yeah. I mean, I will definitely be checking out that tortellini special at Colin's
Friend's
restaurant.
In his memory. The memorial tortellini special.
And I'll leave a bite for him at the grave. And you can also find me on Twitter at Joe Wrote This. You can find us all on VanityFair.com. And we will be back next week with some more Mare. Bye.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal.
We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.